Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Later in the hour, we talk with Carla Kilstedt, writer and performer of Black Inscription, a multimedia performance that takes us into the depths of the ocean. But first, Julie Sicafoose is a name that many may be familiar with. If you're a longtime NPR listener, you've heard her commentaries about wildlife on NPR. She's a writer, illustrator, and licensed wildlife rehabilitator living on an 80-acre reserve in Ohio. Her latest book is Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. Julie Sicafoose joins us on the phone from Ohio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show.
So you've written and illustrated a number of books about wildlife, but this is your first book about one specific bird and your relationship with her. So what set Jemima apart from the other birds that you've rehabilitated? And was there a moment you knew that this bird was different?
Yes. What set her apart is her lineage. She is a corvid. And she's related to crows and ravens, so she's not only brilliant, but she's intensely social. And the moment I realized that I had something special was the first time I held her in my hand. I looked into her eye, and there was somebody there looking back.
Now, Vern Locke's a local ornithologist who is no longer with us, used to say, the only one who can tell a male blue jay from a female blue jay is a blue jay. So how did you determine that Jemima was a female, and did you ever find out if you were right?
Yes, there are actually a couple of ways to do it. First off, she started showing female solicitation behavior early in life, which is where she would spread her wings and vibrate them and kind of keen, and that is something that female blue jays do. There is also there's a brilliant researcher in Newfoundland named Leslie, and she goes by Leslie the Bird Nerd, and she has actually identified female-specific and male-specific calls. So the female-specific call is a growling purr given while the bird bobs up and down. Now, Jemima never got old enough to do that, so I was relying on the female solicitation behavior and also her behavior once she paired up with another bird toward that bird told me that she was a female.
You are a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. Why is it not a good idea for just anyone to keep and raise a wild baby bird?
Well, first off, it's illegal, and the Fish and Wildlife Service demands that you have a federal permit and a state permit to do it, so I hold both of those. The other reason is that, you know, it's just a bad precedent to start keeping any old wild thing as a pet. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, that was what people did. They would catch crows and, you know, have pet wild birds. But, you know, there's some pretty stringent laws about that, and wildlife officers are always looking out for people who are abusing that privilege.
Yeah, and of course we can make mistakes. We don't really understand what their needs are, and you think you're helping and you may actually be hurting.
Right, exactly. So the vast majority of cases where people bring a baby bird into the house, it was being tended by its parents, and it's actually an abduction, a friendly abduction.
Yeah. So how did you get started rehabilitating birds?
I lived when I was a child in Richmond, Virginia, next door to a woman who had 17 cats, and they were all roaming free, and I noted the damage and tried to fix as much of it as I could. And my first experience as an activist as a child was actually when I put some flyers in her mailbox from the Humane Society about how many cats are euthanized when they're taken to the shelter. Mm-hmm. And the next day, she packed them all into the car and had them all neutered and spayed and kept them inside from then on.
Wow.
And it was like a miracle.
Wow.
So great.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we were friends until her death. She was a lovely person who just didn't realize the damage she was doing to the birds in the neighborhood.
So tell us the story of how Jemima came into your life.
A friend of mine sent me a photo on Facebook, and I was doomed from the moment I saw the photo. I saw this little dehydrated jay dying, and I was like, bring it to me. So that's that's the danger of social media.
Yeah. So do you have any theories as to why she was out of the nest?
Yes, I actually do. She was ill when I got her, like really ill, and I think she was probably shouldered out of the nest by the other young ones because she couldn't compete.
Yeah.
You know, jays are smart enough to also toss a baby out of the nest, so although I could never prove that, that's another possibility.
Yeah. So obviously there's some evidence that mother birds will boot their babies from the nest if they sense something is wrong with their baby, right? But
yes,
could you
absolutely
sense something was wrong with this with Jemima?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, mm. yeah. She was way more than just dehydrated and hungry. She was ill, mm. and I got her better, and then that illness came back to haunt her after release with mm. the stress of release. And so, yeah, it never really left until I gave her a course of medication that cured it.
Yeah. Now, imprinting is always a concern when birds are being raised by humans. Explain what imprinting is and what you've learned about imprinting as you raised Jemima.
Well, imprinting, as the specter as raised by many wildlife rehabilitators, is a truly imprinted bird will try to seek out people once it becomes sexually mature as partners. And that's a real problem when you've got a great horned owl trying to mate with your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good thing.
No.
Yeah. So you don't want birds to get that idea. However, it's not as big an issue with songbirds. The exception, the possible exceptions is the corvids, the crows, jays, and ravens, because they're so social, because they're so intelligent, and because they bond so tightly with the social unit to with which they're presented. They can actually get the idea that they're, you know, attracted to people.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did to prevent that was to give Jemima sight and sound of blue jays just a few feet outside the window all day long. I put peanuts on the deck railing, all the stuff that blue jays like, and they came and went all day, and she was just rapt watching them. I kept the window open so she could hear their vocalizations, and it really seemed to cement in her, yes, you always have been a blue jay, and you will be a blue jay again.
Now, you mentioned the corvid families and how their intelligence, which we've seen lots of research on, especially crows. What were some of the ways Jemima demonstrated her intelligence that set her apart from some of the other birds that you've rehabilitated?
Well, you know, just everyday funny stuff like begging to hear certain tunes on my daughter's iPhone, you know, hopping up and pecking the iPhone, like, play something, you know, that kind of thing. But also, once she got outside, I observed her burying, caching some food in the ground, some corn, and a towhee was also watching her. And when she was done caching, the towhee flew down and dug up the corn and ate it. Jemima sat there and sulked for a little bit, waited until the towhee left, and then moved all of her caches.
That shows
an ability to project events into the future.
Yeah.
And that also shows an intent to deceive, and I think that's one of the strongest indicators of intelligence in birds.
You put out the word that you wanted another jay so that Jemima would bond with one of her species. You got a jay, but he was sick and didn't respond to treatment, and unfortunately was euthanized, a task which fell to you. This was not the first time you've had to do this. Talk about how that it affects you, the end of the life of this animal.
It's the worst. It's the absolute worst to have to take the life of a young thing. But my avian vet consultant, you know, said, you know, if he hasn't responded to Baytril after a week, this isn't going to get better, and he's damaged. He had a blood infection. Unfortunately, when you're doing wildlife rehabilitation, death kind of walks hand in hand with life, and you have to make the judgments when you are no longer going to be effective, or when the animal's quality of life is such that keeping it on this planet is not the kind thing to do. And, you know, I don't have any veterinarians who actually work with me in this part of southern Ohio. Most of them do not want to see a wildlife rehabilitator come through the door, so I've had to learn how to do stuff like that.
Mm.
And it's my least favorite part of the job.
Of course. Now, you don't have a special facility where you raise these birds. You do it in your house. So describe
Correct.
How Jemima became a member of the family and some of her antics as a young bird.
Well, I want to be clear. I have this beautiful nylon tent, like 15 feet by 12 feet, that's out in the garage, and I raise my baby birds in that. You know, they fly around. They don't hurt themselves. Jemima was different. When she went out to the tent, I had it all set up with all kinds of perches and baths and toys. She just moped. And my vision had been that I would raise her with this other bird, Stuart, and that they would, you know, really bond and be released together, but that was not to be. So I was really trying. But when I put her out in the cage, she's in the tent, she stopped eating and she just sat there, just silent. And so it was clear that she wasn't going to thrive if she wasn't going to eat. So I brought her back in the house and just put up with the mess. It was terrible. I had, you know, newspapers everywhere and tried to find her favorite perches and put old towels over them. So by the time she was 40 days old, she really had to go. And the thing I was waiting for, of course, was her being able to feed herself entirely, needing no hand feeding whatsoever.
Yeah, well, she was like, hey, why are you putting me out here with the birds? I'm part of the family.
Oh, pretty much, yeah. And as she got older, she harassed our old dog so much that I had to put her out for timeouts in the tent. And she would put up with that for, you know, a half an hour, and then you'd hear her screaming out there with the classic J alarm call, like, come out here, there's a fox, and it's going to eat me if you don't bring me in the house now.
Gosh. Now, as you mentioned, she was particularly fond of your elderly Boston Terrier. And so how did she make her feelings known, and was that fondness reciprocated?
Chet's role in the relationship was to deal with it, to put up with it. He rolled those big old bulging eyes and just kind of toddled on. Jemima followed him, doing the female solicitation, wing quiver and keening, and she would weave in and out of his legs as he walked. If he would step on her, she'd squawk, keep following. It was very, very funny and a little concerning. You know, I was like, oh, please don't get attached to a dog. This is good. there's just so much to juggle when you have a bird that is that interactive and that bright and that needy, I will say.
Yeah. Now, you documented your journey with Jemima through pictures, but also through watercolor illustrations. You've also painted the day-to-day development of nestling birds in your book, Baby Birds, An Artist Looks in the Nest. What are some of the challenges of capturing wild animals in illustrations? And then what's your favorite illustration of Jemima?
Well, the first challenge of capturing anything from life is that they wiggle a lot and they move a lot. So you have to get very, very quick at drawing them. Really great thing about painting baby birds through their developmental stages is that they will just sit there like a little, you know, object of contemplation, and you can paint to your heart's content. I didn't want to keep them out of the nest very long. 45 minutes was the upper limit. I fed them the entire time and then returned them to the nest. And it's going to alarm a lot of people who've been told you shouldn't take baby birds out of the nest or touch them. But I think looking at the book will reassure you that no one was harmed in the making of the book. My favorite illustration of Jemima, I like a couple of them in the book. There's one where she's screaming at Stuart, the other Jay, on the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And I love that for its domesticity and its the patterns, and it was just really fun to paint. But I also love the one where she's poking her bill in Chet Baker's ear.
That is funny. I also really like the one you have on Chapter 6, Release. It's just sort of like standing on that little, you know, deck rail, looking out, like, what's in front of her. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was an evocative one, too. Yeah, and that was, it's just amazing to raise a creature and to put so much love and work into it and then to just turn it out with the owls and the hawks and the crows and the, you know, the thunderstorms and the heat and everything else that could kill it. And
right.
Kind of say, okay, here are the keys. Good luck.
Yeah, so here you are. You've gotten so attached to this little bird, and now you're about to release it, and you know it's a dangerous world out there for just about any bird, right? You're feeling protective, but at the same time, you know she's got to go.
Yeah, she's got to go. And actually, it's a very joyous time, too. And Jemima's release was the best, smoothest, smartest release I've ever had. That bird was so smart, so savvy. And for the first two or three days, she stayed completely in cover in the same couple of trees, you know. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very cautious. And I really appreciated that. Both of my kids were cautious. They were not, you know, climbers or teeterers, and this bird was too.
Yeah, you refer to your experience raising Jemima as a who served whom, one why.
Yeah, who saved whom? Yeah, and exactly. She was just the project I needed, although it didn't feel like it at the time when I took her in. I was like, oh great, a baby bird.
Yeah.
But
anything, it's like, ah.
Yeah, exactly. I go a special kind of crazy when I'm raising baby birds. It's like, You're just tied to them.
Now, many people think of blue jays as those, you know, loud bullies at the feeder, but you've only become more fascinated with them.
Yeah, I have. And the great, great gift Jemima left me with was this cracked open door to the world of blue jays. How they think, whether they migrate, when they move, how they relate to each other, who's dominant. And the magic thing that I learned how to do with Jemima's help was to tell one from the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's subtle stuff, and it's not for just somebody who's just going to glance out the window. It's something that I do actually compulsively.
Well, yeah, you've also become skilled at identifying individual jays. And if listeners are interested in starting to identify some of the individuals that frequent their feeders, you have some tips in the back. So what's your advice on trying to identify?
Well, my first advice is to have a telephoto lens and take a bunch of pictures. And that's really how I did it. And that's how researchers who are studying whales or leopards or, you know, any creature that can be identified by markings, that's how they do it. You just make a dossier of photos. And the crazy thing that happens is in the making of my book talk, which I'm running around the country giving right now, I went through every photo I had taken from the moment I got Jemima all the way through her stay with me, which was 8 months. And I looked at all those photos again, and I had learned to recognize maybe 4 or 5 jays in the interim that I didn't know were around when I started photographing. So here I would be going through these photos, and I'd go, oh, my God, there's a little bit. Oh, my goodness. And so I was able to document their presence in my yard, you know, a year or two earlier than I had even known they were there.
Mm.
So it was crazy. It became like recognizing friends' faces.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that once Jemima was released, she became ill, and you discover that her flight feathers are breaking off. So tell us some more about that illness and what was happening to her feathers.
Well, it's interesting stuff, and it's particularly a problem with hand-raised corvids, because they are heavy birds and they have, you know, special dietary requirements like many birds. But what happens is if a bird is subject to a period of deprivation while it's a nestling, it will develop weaknesses in its feathers called fault bars, and those fault bars travel just like a pencil line all the way across the wing at the same point in the feather. And that is what happened to Jemima. And if a feather is going to break from wear or an impact, it will break on that fault mark. So one by one, her primary feathers of her wings, the outer 9 feathers, broke off. And so she was compromised in flight. And that made her story all the more compelling to me, is how is this creature surviving?
Mm.
You know, she was outwardly robust, incredibly healthy, incredibly gorgeous, but the legacy of that illness when she was a nestling followed her into adulthood.
Yeah. And then so antibiotics, is that what you used, right?
Yes, I did. I used a Tylosin tartrate. She had Mycoplasma gallisepticum, which is a commonly known as house finch disease.
Mm.
Causes the eyes to swell shut, and it's not a pleasant thing.
Yeah.
So I cured her of that, but what happened was, you know, the deprivation she suffered when she was ill caused this feather breakage, and there was not a thing I could do about that.
So have you seen Jemima since you got her well and off she went? Have you seen her?
The last time I can definitively say I've seen her was December 24th, 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the rest is speculation.
I don't know. Well, maybe you'll never know. If she comes back, though, you'll probably know it's her.
Yeah, I definitely think I will.
You didn't ban her, though, right?
By markings.
No. Okay.
I don't. I don't ban my birds.
All right. Book is titled Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Julia Zuckafoos, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mindy. Thank you very much.
Coming up after break, the multimedia performance Black Inscription.